Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here. I'm grateful for the chance to talk about what we've been working on at the University of Nevada, Reno. I'll just start quickly by showing who's done the work. This is the group as it was back in 2011. Everyone in this picture has graduated. John with a master's, Ryan with a bachelor's, Mayu with her PhD, Asia with a bachelor's, BJ with his PhD, and Kyle Hardman with a master's. Although a lot of these people either set up the experiments I'll be talking about today or worked on them. Then my group as it is now is me, Nada Altaisan, a master's student who's not in this picture, Naima Tariq, a PhD student, Andrew Kenigan, an undergraduate, Samir Regmi, a master's student, and Vijay Singh, who's been working as a postdoc and is looking for a postdoc in some other lab. If anyone knows of any opportunities, he's looking to stay in the field of cold molecules. If you're looking for someone who already has experience, Vijay would be great. All the experiments I'll be talking about today use cryogenic helium buffer gas cooling. I thought I'd talk a little about the ugly experimental details to get them out of the way. All the experiments I'll be talking about today take place inside a copper cell. This is 10 centimeters across. The way we produce our atoms or molecules are by laser ablation of a solid target placed within that cell. We have a pulse laser, which is focused down onto that surface. It ablates the surface, spitting out hot atoms and molecules and clusters and dust and God knows what else. If the cell was under vacuum, these would simply fly across the cell and freeze on the opposite wall without ever cooling. We fill the cell with a high density of helium gas, densities ranging anywhere from 10^15 to 10^18 per cubic centimeter. When the atoms or molecules come out, they collide with that helium gas, and they translationally cool on a timescale of a few hundred microseconds. We choose to work with helium because it's chemically inert, so it shouldn't react with the species we produce, and because it's the only element that still has a sizable vapor pressure down to the temperatures we'll be working at. Once they're cold, the atoms and molecules simply diffuse around the cell till they eventually diffuse to a wall where they freeze. That takes place on some timescale ranging from a few milliseconds to a few seconds, depending on our helium densities. That's the timescale we have to do our experiments. We detect them via laser spectroscopy, and we manipulate their internal states with optical pumping.
Before you go on.
Yeah.
Sorry, I have just a quick question.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've heard people around John.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about neon.
Mm-hmm.
As buffer gas. You say helium is basically the only choice because of it has.
We're gonna be working at 1 Kelvin.
Yeah.
Neon does not have the vapor pressure of neon is insufficient to get these kind of densities.
Okay.
At 1 Kelvin.
So.
We'd have no way of thermalizing them before they traverse the cell.
There would be really something like for whatever pre-stage.
If you.
Or if you have.
Well, if you wanted to work at 10 Kelvin or 15 Kelvin.
Yeah.
Neon would be.
Well, you can.
Yeah.
Can you decrease the density then?
Mm-hmm.
You would have less density also.
If we work with neon at 1 Kelvin or 4 Kelvin, the density will be too low to thermalize the hot atoms before they traverse the cell, and so we'll never wind up with cold atoms or cold molecules. If we're working at 10 Kelvin, or if that's the number, I'm not. I don't remember.
I think 17 Kelvin or something.
On the order of that.
Okay.
Neon would be a viable choice.
And.
If you wanna go hotter still, there are much wider range of gas.
Yeah, sure. With the helium, do you still have a problem that a good part of your molecules end up on the windows?
Eventually, they all end up on the windows.
What do you do?
We have filthy windows.
Okay.
Eventually, we replace them. Yes, the different windows are various degrees of.
Okay.
Of opaque.
Well, those numbers are fully large, so it takes a lot, you know, to make the windows opaque.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
You go.
Okay, just one other question. Do you use the density? These are actually very high densities for.
Yeah.
A cold kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Community perspective, but do you use the density to control the diffusion to the walls, or is that important? Is that one aspect of changing density, you can control that diffusion, right? Or do you.
Yeah, so the.
Need to control.
There are some experiments that I'm not gonna be talking about today where we really like these longer timescales, and so that leads us to working at these higher densities. In the lithium helium experiment I'll be talking about, the helium is actually one of the reactants, so we wanna control that density. In the lithium, in one of the other experiments I'll be talking about, it doesn't really matter what we use, so it depends on the experiment. It's gonna be a problem for. This will always preclude doing something like precision spectroscopy inside the cell because of the pressure shifts. Essentially what we're doing is vapor cell experiments. We just happen to be doing it with atomic and molecular radicals at low temperatures.
Is there one aspect which is kinematic about what the optimum gas is, disregarding the worry about what the vapor pressure is? Mm-hmm. I mean, presumably having as close a mass as possible would have your cooling is optimal.
Probably, but then there's the other section, the cross section as well.
It makes the elastic stuff as big as possible then.
Yeah.
You know, think about a brick wall on a tennis ball. Mm-hmm. There's no cooling.
So. Yeah. So the early time dynamics of the cooling are somewhat complicated. There's a lot of local heating in the plume that's coming out, and typically I've been ignoring all that very early time behavior, partly because our diagnostics aren't optimized for looking at that, and partly because that's not the physics I'm interested in. But to some extent, I don't know that much about that very early time, because we kind of just close our eyes for the first few hundred microseconds, and then cold molecules appear, and then we start doing our experiments. But I think there is some interesting stuff there to look at, but I really haven't looked much into that. So we have a couple apparatuses, one that gets down to a temperature of 4 Kelvin, another one that operates down at 1 Kelvin, which is mostly what I'll be talking about today. And so we can get translational and usually rotational temperatures down to 1 Kelvin. We can produce very large numbers of atoms, numbers on the order of 10 to the 14th in the cell at densities exceeding 10 to the 11th per cubic centimeter. We're not as good at making molecules, so our numbers are down around 10 to the 11th in the cell at peak densities exceeding 10 to the 8th per cubic centimeter. We can hold on to them for as long as 1 second. So the vices of this technique are we're not ultra cold, and I appreciate your allowing me to speak here anyway. We're certainly not in the single partial wave limit by any stretch of the imagination. And all our experiments are going to be done in this high density of helium gas. So we can't do ion detection, and we're limited to pretty much spectroscopy for all our detection of our molecules. Precision spectroscopy is also off the table because of pressure shifts. But what's nice about this is it's pretty easy, which I like. It's very general, and we can get very large numbers.
I just asked, if you've got those molecule numbers, does that mean you also have an associated number of atoms there as well, or have you converted entirely into molecules at that point?
So here, I'm not converting, we're just ablating and seeing what we produce. So
okay.
For diatomic molecules, depending on the molecule, for one that works well, we can get these kind of numbers. For atoms, for an atom that works well, we can get these kind of numbers.
But you won't have a mix.
But we can also have a mix, which is the first experiment I'll be talking about.
And there's any restriction of the molecules that you can use, or?
So something where you can figure out how to get it in. So at the moment, all I've been doing is laser ablating solid precursors. And so far, I've had good luck in all the molecules I've been looking for, titanium monoxide, calcium monohydride, CH, have all been made in actually quite good numbers inside our cell. But if you order up some nice benzene rings, I'll probably have a hard time.
What's the lowest number of molecules that you can detect?
The lowest number varies a bit from experiment to experiment. Again, depending on the transition and whether we're doing absorption spectroscopy, laser-induced fluorescence. Offhand, I'm hesitant to quote a number on that. For the number, we can easily see 10 to the 8 in laser-induced fluorescence. Whether or not we can get to 10 to the 6, I'm not quite sure about.
Well, above that.
Yeah.
One more question.
Yeah.
You're related to this earlier question. Mm-hmm. So, is there any pollution there? Like, so you get just those molecules? Like, when you ablate?
No, there's pollution. And even
worse is that
we're doing all this narrowband spectroscopic detection, so we can see, we're quite sensitive at seeing things that we're looking for, but we're very insensitive at seeing things we're not looking for. And so, a large part of the work in these experiments is going through the systematic checks to make sure that what we're measuring is what we think we're measuring, and not something else that happened to appear inside the buffer gas and is dominating the behavior. And so that's what makes the experiments harder, is trying to rule out all other possible things that could be going on.
So you're saying you might get as many of some other type of molecule?
So So for example, in one of the experiments I'll be showing, we're ablating calcium dihydride to produce calcium monohydride. I'm sure we're getting a lot more hydrogen atoms than we are calcium monohydride molecules in that experiment. But again, I can't see them, so I can't tell you that for sure, but I would bet as much money as you'd like on that. We've done a variety of experiments with these. I'll just mention some of the things I won't be talking about just in case anyone is interested in discussing it. We've been measuring atom collisions. We focus on atoms with anisotropic interaction potentials, both on their collisions with the helium and collisions with each other. We've done some experiments with atomic ytterbium, looking at nonlinear optics. At the moment, I also have another experiment going on of freezing atoms in solid crystals of noble gases. At the moment, we're working with argon crystals doped with helium. But given the conference, I'd want to focus on the molecular stuff. So we've measured various kinds of inelastic collisions of different molecules with helium, which I won't be talking about, but we'll be glad to discuss at some other time. We've measured two chemical reactions. The first one I'll be talking about is molecular calcium monohydride chemically reacting with atomic lithium in a displacement reaction to produce lithium hydride and a calcium atom. And the other one is lithium chemically reacting with helium in three-body recombination to produce lithium helium. So just a few minutes ago, I told you we chose to work with helium because it's chemically inert. That was a lie. And we started to measure some of the effects of that. Some of the stuff we'd like to do is...
Oh, sorry, can I just ask?
Yeah.
The lithium-helium thing, is that in its ground state that is only bind when it's electronically...
No, that's ground state lithium-helium. Yeah, absolutely. Well, the stuff we'd like to do, we'd like to develop techniques to control chemical reactions, investigate tunneling-driven reactions at these cold temperatures, further explore van der Waals molecules like lithium-helium, and then eventually I would like to move away from all this stuff in the buffer gas and extract the molecules in the buffer gas via beam experiment like pioneered in John Doyle's lab and Dave DeMille's lab, which is they now have beams that give slow, low-energy molecules. Because I'm new to this field, I like using their first generation of beams, which are very high flux but have a large forward boost. And I think Heather Lewandowski last week talked briefly about how this could be nicely combined with the Stark decelerator to get rid of that forward boost and perhaps transfer it to a trap. And to that end, I've been ablating to produce organic molecules, CH, which are nice for this forward boosted beam because of their light mass. They'll have low forward energy. And they have an internal structure that couples nicely to the Stark decelerator. But pretty much today, all I'll be talking about is this topic there. So moving to cold chemistry, a little bit of motivation for cold chemistry rather than ultra-cold chemistry. So again, we're going to start by looking at cold two-body chemical reactions, these kind of displacement reactions between an atom and a diatomic molecule. At cold temperatures, this might be of interest for studying the physics of interstellar molecular clouds. Thanks to spectroscopy, people know a lot about the constituents of these birthplaces of stars and planets, and there are a lot of interesting organic molecules in there. But very little is known about how they might react at the cold temperatures of these clouds. And so we can simulate those same conditions in our experiments. It's of interest for studying the fundamental physics of chemical reactions. We can prepare our reactants in pure row vibrational states and reduce thermal averaging versus normal hot chemistry. But again, we're still working in the many partial wave limit. And perhaps by going...
Many is not the right word, right? So it's not many, right? It's a few.
Depends. So with helium, it's definitely a few, but depending on how heavy the reactants are, it might be many. Yeah, lithium actually... Well, hey, what's your threshold for many?
Well, I mean, you're below.
Yeah. Minute. Okay. Yeah. I usually one too many is my counting. a few partial waves.
I'm just saying that there's a big difference between five partial waves.
Yeah. And okay. We're in the few partial wave limit, which that's also very true for how sensitive you are to the molecular potentials in the reaction rates. How things react may be important for future work with ultra-cold molecules, where experiments want to work with very high-density samples of molecules. This is of interest for developing new techniques of controlling chemical reactions, either through collisional resonances, like in atomic scattering, or through internal state preparation. And we like using buffer gas cooling to approach this because, well, that's what we do. But also, this lets us address a wide range of candidate reactants. And it lets us be sensitive to low reaction rates because of the large numbers and densities and long interaction times that we have. So the first thing we wanted to study, we're just looking at barrierless reactions because that seemed like the easiest, looking at atomic lithium reacting with molecular calcium monohydride, which can react to produce lithium hydride and a calcium atom and roughly 1 electron volt of energy. We find we can produce calcium hydride by laser ablation of calcium dihydride and detect it on a couple of strong laser diode accessible wavelengths. And it ablates quite nicely and we can get high numbers and densities. We can produce lithium by laser ablation of lithium metal and detect it on the D1 transition in a laser diode accessible wavelength. One of the nice things about lithium is we get very large densities and numbers, which are hard to monitor spectroscopically because the cloud is so opaque. But lithium has this nice lower natural abundance isotope, so we can monitor this one to make accurate measurements and infer how much lithium-7 we have in the cell.
Question?
Yeah.
So what are your vibrational rotational excitations? Are you mostly in the ground?
So in calcium hydride, we're mostly in the ground. So the B constant, I think, is around 12 wave numbers. Or no, maybe that's the splitting of the rotational levels. It's quite large compared to our temperature. So we're mostly in the ground rotational state. Although in stuff I'm skipping here, if we were at 4 Kelvin, the small amount in the excited rotational state would actually be quite problematic for us in how it would influence the collisional properties. There is going to be a small amount in excited vibrational levels, typically down by at least an order of magnitude from the ground state, from the ground vibrational level. And that can hang around for a while. But because it's a relatively small population, we tend to ignore that in our experiments. And because we're doing laser spectroscopy, we're just sensitive to whatever state we're looking at.
But the vibrational excited states may be much more reactive, you know, maybe more reactive, right? So if you have a factor of 10, that's the population, it can still play its
important role. It can if there was transfer of population between them. Here, because of the temperature, there's no transfer of population.
But are you looking at the products of the chemical reaction, or what are you detecting?
So we have a lot of lithium and a small amount of calcium hydride. So the calcium hydride will have very little effect on the lithium. But the lithium should make the calcium hydride go away more rapidly. So we're going to detect this by the rapid disappearance of calcium hydride. We're also going to detect the reaction by the appearance of lithium hydride. Although because we're going to be doing that by laser-induced fluorescence, we don't know the complete distribution of vibrational states produced in that product, I can't use the detection of lithium hydride to extract anything quantitative about the reaction. It's for fun. Yeah?
How do you time the ablation pulses by which you produce the lithium and calcium?
Generally, we're introducing them at the same time.
How can you tell that it's not the hydrogen atoms that are reacting with the lithium atoms in the first reaction?
We can. This is getting ahead by a few slides, but we vary how hard we're ablating this, which would vary the amount of hydrogen atoms produced, and we don't see any change in the reaction rate coefficient. Is the short answer to that? But yeah, there could be a lot of such processes going on. And again, so some of this is old data, so I'll go through it somewhat quickly. This is what we see. If we just ablate calcium hydride into our cell with no lithium. We ablate at T equals zero on the scale. We're just looking at the transmission of a laser being sent through and extracting the optical density, which I like because it's proportional to the number density of calcium hydride in the cell. At early times, we see this shoots up as the cold calcium hydride molecules enter the beam. The early time dynamics is complicated, but if you wait long enough, the time dynamics becomes very simple. As it decays down to the lowest order diffusion mode, and you just get this simple exponential decay. Yeah.
The time zero is when you start the ablation pulse.
We send in a single ablation pulse, 5 nanoseconds long.
It's time zero.
Yeah, that's happening right here at zero.
Why do you have molecules before that?
This is a measure of the noise in our. If it wasn't on a log scale, you could see that this average would be zero. because it's on a log scale, you only see the positive points. But yeah, that's our noise. in this measurement. This is just a single shot as well. And actually, in this data, well, yeah.
So the initial rise is the cooling?
Hmm?
The initial rise is the...
No, so it's so this is a time scale of hundreds of milliseconds. The cooling takes place in a few hundred microseconds. So what this is motion of the molecules around the cell. So I have a small beam going through the center of the cell, and I'm monitoring the density there. So this is what we're seeing, this rise is as those cold molecules are moving into the center. Over time, so the initial density distribution is complicated. If you wait long enough, all the higher order diffusion modes decay, and you're just left with the lowest order diffusion mode, which is a nice simple cosine function, and gives this nice simple exponential decay in time. But what's going on here is a little bit tricky, and we try to ignore that as much as we can, although we don't get completely away from that. Okay, so now if we introduce lithium in at that same time as the calcium hydride, the blue curve here is just the same curve from the last graph, what we'd see without the lithium repeated. The green points up here are the lithium density as a function of time. Again, it rises as they move out into the beam and then decays away. I'm not sure why this is not plotted on a log scale. If we watch the calcium hydride, what we see is this red curve. Initially, when there's very little overlap of the lithium atoms with the calcium monohydride molecules, the evolution in time is not changed. But then as they start to overlap, you can see the calcium hydride begins to go away much faster in the presence of lithium than it would without, as seen by this steeper slope. If you wait long enough, eventually this slope returns to be the same as this slope, because all the lithium has gone away, and you're back to just loss from diffusion. We can model what's going on. We model loss due to both diffusion and this chemical reaction, where the rate coefficient K, the density of lithium, and the density of the calcium monohydride. You go through some various songs and dances to get rid of this diffusion term and just get something where it's left with this rate coefficient times the lithium density, which we define this mathematical quantity as the reaction rate. The assumptions we have to make to get to this point are not quite right. We're assuming things about the density of the lithium and the calcium hydride. And so in the end, we're going to have some uncertainty because of those approximations. To try to do better on that, we take pictures of the distributions of lithium and calcium hydride at those early times. But the problem is the pictures only give us two-dimensional information. And the distribution is complicated. And so we can't fully extract what the density distributions are. And because of that, we wind up with roughly a factor of two uncertainty in this rate coefficient we're going to pull out. But if we look at this reaction rate as a function of the lithium density, we see this nice linear dependence. And from this, we can pull out, well, if I converted this optical density into an actual density, we could pull out a rate coefficient from this. But of course, where we have to do most of our work is making sure that it's really the reaction we think it is and not something else. So one possible other source would be that perhaps it's going away because of helium-mediated reactions, such as three-body recombination. We do have a very high helium density. So we repeat this experiment at various helium densities spanning well over an order of magnitude, and we see no change in the rate coefficient.
Question. I thought you measured this linear dependence on the lithium
Yeah, it would be an awful coincidence if it. But so say it's calcium. Well, say the reaction is calcium hydride and lithium come together with a helium third body, and they form calcium hydride lithium, or whatever that molecule would be called. That would also be linear in the lithium density. Or say there. Well, I guess this is next on the list. And so we vary the helium density, and see no effect. So we can rule out that going on. Similarly, there could be other things that are produced in ablation. The hydrogen that's no doubt produced when we ablate the calcium monohydride, dust, clusters, metastable states. But all of these things, or the ratio of these things to the atomic lithium, should depend on how hard we ablate, or how long we wait after ablation, because they'll have different diffusion rates, or the density of helium, which strongly influences the production of dust and clusters. And we see it's independent of these things. And so we use that to rule out this class of reactions. Another possibility is that maybe as we're ablating the lithium, we're stirring the gas more, or we're heating it up, which is going to take things to the walls. But we're constantly monitoring the temperature with Doppler spectroscopy, so we can rule out the higher temperature. And if it was hydrodynamic transport around the cell, that would affect the lithium as well, which we don't see. And we can't just be transferring our calcium hydride molecules to some other state that we're not looking at, because all other states would be energetically forbidden, because we're looking at the ground rotational and vibrational state. And the one other thing we do, mostly because it's fun, is we can measure the reaction product in this reaction. So we look around for the lithium hydride transition. We look for lithium hydride in laser-induced fluorescence, because we don't have that much of it. And we see, right, where we should see a peak, we see this nice peak. Now, the sensible thing to do is to look for the ground vibrational state of lithium hydride. But at the time, I did not have a laser which could access the transition from the ground state. And so this data is actually looking at a transition from the excited vibrational state of the ground electronic state going to an excited state, different vibrational state, just to get the frequency in the right place.
Why are you saying that the sensible thing would be to look for the ground state?
Because eventually, if we're making lithium hydride, I would imagine it's all eventually going to wind up in the ground vibrational state.
Why?
It has a pretty fast radiative decay lifetime, on the order of tens of milliseconds. Which
because,
I get,
because the chemical reaction will not necessarily produce...
That's right. So, which is, I'm getting a lot of order here, but that's actually one of the things I like about this technique. The first, we can see the products produced. So unlike in a trap, so this lithium hydride is produced with some fraction of an eV of energy. It's coming out hot. And in a trap for neutral molecules, that would simply be lost. But here in the buffer gas, 100 microseconds later, it's translationally cooled and then starts to slowly diffuse away. And so we can accumulate large numbers of these molecules, large enough we can detect. The other thing that's happening is it's going to be rotationally cooled very rapidly. We looked for excited rotational lines and did not see them. That's nice because that also enhances the signal. But obviously, it's not being instantly vibrationally cooled because we can see this excited vibrational state. And so now this allows for the possibility of trying to measure the distribution of vibrational states produced.
That'd be exciting.
And you'll notice that everything's a positive. The rotational cooling I'm selling as a positive. The vibrational lack of cooling I'm also trying to sell as a positive. But try to see the sunny side of things. It would be really nice to see the distribution of rotational states produced, but we don't have the prospects for doing that. And actually, our signal to noise would not be good enough.
Well, I think to measure the vibrational distributions would be great, because you could then think about, you know, looking at near resonant, you know, chemical reactions, like, you know, thinking about the effects of dynamical factors, you know, and that's been a hot topic in chemical dynamics, you know, for a very, very long time.
Thanks.
You also have helium there, right? I mean,
yes.
Could you? I mean, is like a pressure shift? Is it relevant at all?
It could be. On this particular spectrum, our calibration of the absolute frequency isn't good enough to see a pressure shift versus the quoted literature. We don't see any pressure broadening on this. That the line width you see there is dominated by Doppler broadening. But with other species, we have observed pressure shifts and pressure broadening. Although with some of them, we have to go to Doppler-free spectroscopy to pull those out. Just because even at 1 Kelvin, you still have significant line width from the Doppler broadening, especially for these light molecules. That's right. And so we can look at this laser-induced fluorescence as a function of time. Now this is in milliseconds here after the ablation pulses. And we see it right comes up as we are making more and more of these molecules and then eventually goes away because eventually everything goes away. We can compare this to what we'd expect to see from how much calcium hydride and lithium we have in the cell. And modeling this is a little bit tricky because in this model, well, we know how much we have, and we know the reaction rate, so we know how fast we're producing lithium hydride. But how much lithium hydride we'll have will depend on how long the lithium hydride stays in the cell. It can go away from diffusion. It can go away from this excited vibrational level decaying by either radiation or collisional quenching. And so we vary this lifetime, and our data, which are the red points, are consistent with the simulation with these lifetimes ranging from 0 to 11 milliseconds. These blue points over here are what we'd expect for a lifetime of 4 milliseconds. And these numbers are consistent with loss due to diffusion and the calculated radiative lifetime of this excited vibrational state, which is 12 milliseconds. So it's possible we have collisional quenching going on here, but we're not sensitive enough to measure that. Yeah, and so we like looking at the reaction products. I think there's a lot of future in that. But then for the reaction rate coefficient, to get that, we have to take that from the calcium hydride data, because that's where we know the absolute levels. And so what we find for the reaction rate coefficient at these cryogenic temperatures is it's fast, 3.6 times 10 to the minus 10 centimeters cubed per second, again, with a factor of 2 uncertainty in that number from our modeling. And this seems fast to me, but I think this is generally what's expected for cold barrierless reactions. So one of the reasons why we're interested in this particular reaction is trying to explore this idea that I was first introduced to by Roman, is that if you have an exothermic reaction between a doublet S atom and a doublet sigma molecule, like lithium and calcium hydride, we should be able to control that reaction by controlling the spin states of the reactants. So whether or not this reaction will be barrierless or barriered will depend on whether you prepare it in the singlet state or the triplet state. And so we should be able to control reactions simply by polarizing the reactants. But really, polarizing the reactants is only practical if you're starting with a cold sample. Whether you're polarizing them by optical pumping, where you'd need the concentration of rotational and vibrational levels so you don't need thousands of lasers, or whether you're doing it by field selection, where you also need them to be cold in at least one dimension, you need to be working with cold molecules to do this. And so we're going to take a look at this with our candidate reaction. So just to talk about some prior work that's been done, this is the same principle that was done over 3 decades ago with atomic hydrogen, where they found they could shut off three-body recombination by spin polarizing the hydrogen atoms. And this is, I like to think of this as a generalization of the potassium-rubidium experiment at Gila, where there they're able to shut off reactions by using the identical fermion nature of the reactants in the ultra-cold limit. Here we'd like to control it by using the identical fermion nature of electrons, which should be much more general. And I should also point out that evidence for this suppression has already been seen in work in John Doyle's lab, where they had nitrogen atoms and imodogen molecules co-trapped in a magnetic trap. And so they have complete spin polarization of their two species, and they don't see it react. And one would probably expect it to react if there wasn't this suppression, so surely the effect is going on. We'd like to see a little bit more explicitly than that in a case where we can turn on and off the reaction. And just to present my simple experimentalist picture of how this works, because I don't fully understand Roman's picture, I like to think of this as if I have this atom, the molecule colliding in the triplet state, they'll be producing lithium hydride in the triplet state rather than the singlet state, and that turns out to be an endothermic reaction, which should be completely shut off at these cold temperatures. Which is a very simple model. I don't need to really understand anything about the molecular structure other than what I can look up in the NIST chemistry web book. But the one thing is that for this to hold as a way of shutting off reactions, what has to happen is that these spins can't flip during a collision, which I was a little bit worried about, because historically I've been taught that molecules are very bad at flipping their spins, or they really like to flip their spins all the time. They're very bad in inelastic collisions. But actually some recent calculations, actually not that recent anymore, I should update this with the actual publication, of lithium-calcium hydride interactions indicate that the inelastic rate actually will be rather low compared to the elastic rate. And so we would expect that these inelastic collisions would not be a problem during the chemical reaction. And so we expect to be able to get a high degree of control. And so the way we attempted to do this in our first attempt is we'd like to control the spin states of reactants with optical pumping. Lithium is a beautiful atom, and so once we can polarize that, it remains polarized even after having millions of collisions with helium atoms. The calcium hydride spin-changing rate coefficient depends very strongly on the temperature, and so our first generation apparatus wasn't sufficient for this. We would polarize the calcium hydride, and it would rapidly depolarize in collisions with helium. But now that we're down working around 1 Kelvin, we can keep it, once polarized, it stays polarized for long enough to do the experiment. And so the idea was just to polarize them either parallel or anti-parallel and look for differences in the reaction rate. But we've been having some problems with that. And the problem actually is more, we believe, with the lithium now than it is with the calcium hydride. So at low densities, the optical pumping works nicely. But to measure this reaction, to make this reaction easy to see, we need to work at extremely high lithium densities. And high lithium densities means the lithium cloud is opaque, or nearly opaque, very high optical density. And it becomes very difficult to optically pump, because now every time you scatter a photon, that photon will diffuse out through your cloud, literally scattering off of hundreds of other atoms, which is a well-known problem from various optical pumping at room temperature experiments. And so what we'd like to do in the future is introduce some broadening mechanism to reduce the optical density while still keeping the high lithium density.
Do you still think this is a better approach than a magnetic trap?
The magnetic trap, I don't know how to turn the collisions back, turn the reactions back on.
By a red flipping.
But then they'll be lost from the trap.
Well,
won't they?
Depends on the scale, right?
Yeah.
Scale,
that's true. No, if you have multiple, if
you have no losses, right? You can get a reaction without any trapping.
Yeah. So actually, now that we've measured the reaction rate at 1 Kelvin, we could just go to the pure trap. But there's some overhead in that as well. And I think I can do this just by putting the field gradient on, which is easier than the trap. not as elegant. That's true. The trap should, and here we'll be limited in how much we can control it by how pure we can get those spin states. Well, with a trap, you have essentially complete spin purity, so that would be a much cleaner measurement. I agree. But at the moment, in the immediately foreseeable future, trapping is a little bit beyond our technical capabilities.
Yes? Stupid questions, always. With geometries, do you have the high lithium optical densities in all directions?
So we have roughly a cubic cell, so yes. But if we put the field gradient on, then no.
Because, I mean, this is what usually we do with optical pumping, right?
Yeah.
We do it from sites on there.
Yeah. No, so we've talked about trying to build a cell with a different geometry,
okay.
So we can get a slow path through. I think that would be nice, although tricky for some other technical reasons inside our apparatus. Yes?
You do optical pumping of the cells, so you assume that you are optically pumping everything inside of the cell?
So not the entire volume, so because we can't address the entire volume, but we can address the majority of it. We have relatively high optical access into our cell, and the densities are concentrated in the center. So we don't get 100% of the cell, but I think we get enough. But again, that's going to be another limitation of our ability to control this, is how well we can pump everything.
When you do this evaluation of rate constant, so you assume that everything can be used.
So that was the simplest version.
Right.
We correct for the inhomogeneities, but we can't correct completely for them. Because, again, I don't have complete knowledge of that density distribution. So we have some knowledge, and we use that to improve things a bit. The actual numbers don't have that assumption in them, but that assumption makes the explanation of how we do it very simple. And it's just inelegant the way we actually do it.
Can I ask maybe a live physics question, and probably it sounds stupid chemically, is the role of the singlet and the triplet always that way around, or can it be reversed? In terms of whether the reaction rate's faster or slower,
I would expect it's always that way and never reverse. But I would be
molecules that have net spin in their ground state, like O2 or something. Whether there are other examples where things maybe look around.
O2 is an interest. Yeah.
Same with ground state.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but for different reasons, right? I mean, higher speed means more polar repulsion, right? And that's what gives rise to those reaction barriers, right? So normally we expect that higher speed states would have, higher barriers.
So even when you the ground state, it's got net spin to it?
Yes, I think so.
Before my answer would have been the same as Roman, with O2 and NH.
So when you talk about O2, are you comparing the triple space to what?
Sorry, I wasn't making such an educated point. It was just thinking of the difference between diatomics where the grand state was either a singlet or a triplet, and wondering whether if you had something with a grand state which is a triplet in this scenario, would it be different or interchange the roles of the two channels?
No, I don't think that would be the case.
It was a stupid question.
I'll defer to Roman.
Well,
I think probably don't want to derail our discussion, but it's definitely worth talking about. Actually, this is a good time to talk about it. I'm going to shift gear. Oh, no. One review before shifting gears. So where do cold reactive collisions fit in to the field? So, I mean, one could argue that Feshbach association and photo association have already demonstrated near perfect control of chemical reactions between two atoms. And now in the Boulder group, they've used the molecules produced by these wonderful control methods and then controlled the reactions between those molecules. And so to some extent, many of the goals I'm talking about have already been done very elegantly and cleanly. And so where I see this fitting in is we'd like to extend these principles to a broader range of reactions at a broader range of conditions to try to bridge the gap between ultra-cold AMO physics and chemistry. Although, Paul, did you have some objection?
I was just going to comment on the atoms. I guess you can control the target states to some extent.
Yeah.
But the molecules are essentially no control yet whatsoever in terms of kind of like products or
what you get.
So in a certain sense, you're controlling the incoming part of it. So,
yeah.
So there's a lot of stuff potentially for molecule work there.
Okay.
Can I ask you something? So what I find most interesting about it is the possibility to actually look at the non-adiabatic effects at very low temperatures. Because you know, if the reaction on the triplet state is going to happen, it's going to happen for the non-adiabatic couplings in the singlet state. Hence my figure in the case. And so you could be probing non-adiabatic effects by measuring the reaction rate of those species. And that I don't think has been done at such low temperatures. So I think the question of the role of non-adiabatic, isn't it, in chemical dynamics at low temperatures is an open one, and that's something that I don't think is being addressed in any of the other experiments.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Although, to be completely honest, I think to see those effects, you probably need to go to the trap you were talking about to get the sufficiently high. Well, I guess it depends how large the effects are, but assuming they're relatively small, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
Harry
has done calculations that show that those effects can actually be quite large.
It's non-adiabatic effects that give the reaction in the magnetic trap. Of course, that is in spin coupling is a specific kind of non-adiabaticity.
Can you remind us of the rates that you calculate, that you predict? I mean, Europe is in a zero temperature limit, but
the rate of... Oh, there's, of course, uncertainties of many orders of magnitude in your array. So
we could use yours as a ballpark. What do you find in your calculations?
It's really the ratio. I mean,
the ratio is less meaningful to me because you can't really get your elastics carried on.
I don't have a number here, but it can look at that.
Yeah,
I'm just thinking that you should maybe put it out on the goal.
I like that. Thank you. Yeah, and so somehow I hope it can fit in between the ultra-cold and traditional hot chemistry that has, I think, much less success in controlling two-body chemical reactions.
Because, one could ask a bigger question, like, why do you need to control chemical reactions? I mean, what's the point of it? You're not going to be producing...
Synthesis.
I think the value of this is in learning about the physics of chemistry and this particular intricate, couplings that we knew the form of, but we don't know the effect of those couplings, especially in the picture dynamics.
So now I want to change gears a bit and talk about a different topic, looking at van der Waals molecules, a somewhat controversial topic, the controversy being over this V. According to Physical Review, this should never be capitalized, even if it's in a title or at the beginning of a sentence. But Herit gave me permission to use a capital V, so I'm going ahead and doing it.
So what's the right way?
This is the right way. This is
the sentence. So you capital at the beginning of the sentence? The rule in Dutch is that only if there is an initial or a name in front, then it is lowercase. Otherwise, it is uppercase. And the Flemish rules are different. however the name was registered at birth, that's how you write it, regardless of what is in front of you. I did a careful study on this. Even the rule, if a Dutchman writes about someone from Belgium, then you're supposed to follow the Flemish rules.
So what about if you use just the acronym?
This is left over from the Physical Review.
I'll write a proposal.
So these are molecules, they're bound by long-range dispersion forces. Yes. Or perhaps I shouldn't be calling them molecules at all. Bratislav was suggesting I call them clusters instead. These are the most weakly bound forms of matter. While a normal molecule might be bound by 10 to the 4 wave numbers and have a smaller atomic spacing, a van der Waals molecule is bound by a 4 orders of magnitude less, or even more extreme in the molecules I'll be talking about, and has a much larger interatomic spacing. So very long-range weakly bound molecules. The most weakly bound of all the van der Waals molecules are helium compounds, and here I'm talking about the ground electronic state. The excited electronic states can be bound by significant amounts of energy. Maybe a very long time ago there was a controversy over their existence, but I think now people have enough faith in ab initio calculations that people believe whatever the calculations say.
Is that true for helium-3 as well as helium-4?
Oh, so it's not all helium-3 diatomic compounds exist.
Yeah, the critical number is quite big, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether that's experimentally ever been really checked.
I think helium-3.
For the isotope
helium-3?
Yes.
It has been checked, yes.
It's, the minimum number is about 20.
So you say helium-3 is in terms of the isotope or triatomic?
No, I mean the isotope. Yeah.
But for the isotope helium-3, the potential is the same for both isotopes, helium-4 and helium-3,
yes.
but the reduced mass is sufficiently smaller for helium-3, the potential does not suffice to bind even the mixed isotope helium-3 helium-4.
Yes.
Potential slopes,
I think with helium-3, there's a minimum number of helium-3 atoms of 4 bound state, which is of the order of 20, theoretically. But I don't know experimentally whether that's ever really been checked.
I think there has been some work by Tennis and company. I'm talking about helium-3 and trimers now. I remember there was a time when people were debating the existence of the Pimlab states in those trimers. Mm-hmm. Has that been sorted out?
Anything more than diatomic is too much for me.
I have a very similar question. So other than what you call normal molecules, which are bound by somehow shared electrons, can you actually, if you can bind two, can you automatically always bind more?
I would think so, but I cannot. I'm always finite surprised.
Am I? Nothing special anymore. What you can say? Primer or Pimlab state?
Exactly,
yeah.
That, right?
You have. Is it or is it not? I don't think so.
Well, I mean, like you can have trimers, but not dimers, right now.
Yeah, that's right. But the question is, my question was, if you have this van der Waals molecule, it might be a very naive question. I'm really not very familiar with that. Whether you can have any kind of any number of clusters, or any number, not two, not just two, but two, three, or five, or seven, or 17.
I think normal that we're to have the dipper.
Yeah. Okay. But isn't there any shell structure? I mean, is it really monotonic? If you take the binding, the total binding energy divided by the number of constituents, is it really monotonically there?
I don't think it's monotonic, but that's because of geometry, not because of the...
Just makes you wonder.
Forces not going to add anything. Yeah, there's pressure. Yeah. So at long range, it's just going to be a sum of that.
So most of them are also not really, really spherical. I mean, they're everything.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, no, but this is already tells that it's not, not really the nature of the binding.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's in part of all of them. Okay, thanks. Is that different for us?
Yes. So again, almost two decades ago now, helium-2 was the first diatomic helium molecule that was observed. It was observed in diffraction experiments. And what we're doing now are experiments spectroscopically detecting helium molecules. Although not helium with other helium, helium with lithium is what we're going to look for. So the evidence of forming these van der Waals molecules has been seen in a lot of collision experiments in buffer gases, in room temperature optical pumping and spin exchange experiments. The collisions show evidence that these molecules are forming. And in low temperatures and cryogenic buffer gas cooling experiments, the collisions also showed some evidence for the existence of these molecules. Specifically, in a couple semi-recent publications from the Doyle group, they have indirect evidence that indicates they were forming silver helium molecules, which they can detect the presence of through their effect on the collisional properties of silver with helium. And so the suggestion was that we should be able to detect these molecules spectroscopically, which Bretislav suggested to me more than a decade ago, and I didn't follow up on. And more recently, Thad Walker and Nate Brahms were pushing me to do this, and I finally got around to doing it. We have lithium in a cold helium buffer gas, so we can look for lithium helium. We should always start with a literature search to see what people have done before. So if you type this into Wikipedia, you'll find Li He, I believe. I'm told that's how this person's name is pronounced. But that's not the L-I-H-E we're looking for. So there's a nice theory paper, 1999, that calculated the structure of helium bound to all the different alkali atoms and the resulting molecules and their wave function. For helium-4, a molecule in its ground state should exist bound to all the alkali atoms, and many of the alkali atoms will also show a bound state with helium-3. Typical well depths for this are around one wave number. The lithium-helium molecular potential is actually shallower than the helium-helium molecular potential. And typical binding energies are on the order of a millo wave number. And so this is the expected wave function for lithium-helium here. Not quite as long range as the helium dimer, but really a very, very large weakly bound molecule.
Why is the lithium helium potential more shallow?
That is a good question.
I did not hear the question.
Why is the lithium helium potential more shallow
than helium dimer? So the long range part is more attractive, but it becomes repulsive at much larger distances. And this is because I think you can explain it better than I can.
Yes, or a little so big.
The reason is the same as the polarized approach. And in this case, the distance of closest approach is determined by the polarized approach. The always of the atom in the dimer, there is a higher polarized approach, determines the distance of closest approach. And the polarized approach of lithium is much greater than that of helium. So that's why the lithium helium dimer, the repulsion sets in at higher the separation than the helium helium. This is about twice as large equilibrium distance.
Yes, and actually this trend does continue. I mean, the visibility of sodium is a bit higher than lithium.
So because the atomic radius of lithium is a lot larger than helium, so it just can't, the chemical exchange repulsion just sets in further out?
That's how I would see it, yes.
Is the you know, compactness of the binding of the helium atom compared with, you know, lack of compactness compared with the
Pauli exclusion?
Yeah. Well, I think it's because the attraction, the normal attraction is so weak, so that the short range physics dominates more. Because normally, if you were to replace helium with neon, the trend would be as expected, right? Go to bigger species, they would be more attractive. But that's because you have more fluorescibility at low, you know, that gives larger C6 coefficients, so you go in stronger, and the repulsion, you know, starts playing a role at shorter distances.
I should say that that thing about the micropotentials also surprised me when I first saw that. I had other people explain it to me. So these things should exist. So weakly bound that they only have a single low vibrational state. They can't rotate without falling apart. And so what we're going to do to look for them is we're going to form large densities of cold atomic lithium and helium by the same way I was telling you about before. And then we'd expect to form these molecules by three-body recombination, where lithium comes together with two helium atoms to form a lithium-helium molecule or cluster, and an extra helium atom takes away the energy. Of course, this reaction can run both ways, where a helium atom knocks into this molecule and collisionally dissociates it into the constituent atoms. So this is another form of cold chemistry, if you'll allow me that. Yes?
Do you think you go into thermal equilibrium here, or is this a non-equilibrium?
The thermal equilibrium actually extremely rapidly.
Okay.
So rapidly that I can't measure how fast it's happening, although I'd like to.
Yeah, back maybe 5 or 10 years ago, we suggested to use that as a way to separate isotopes, because that reaction, the equilibrium is going to be very different for different isotopes. I mean, we did, I think, lithium with H2 or something like that. Mm-hmm. That reaction would be very different.
So we should make these molecules. We should look for them spectroscopically. And the spectroscopy should be really easy because there's only one ground state. That's the kind of molecular spectroscopy I'm willing to do. This is what the structure should look like. So this is that ground state potential. All these potentials were cobbled together from these references. Ground state potential is a well depth of slightly over one wave number, turning point at very large distances. This is in nanometers here. The excited state potentials, we have a deeply bound A state. You can see the scale here is completely changed from the one down here. This A state supports multiple vibrational levels. And then we have this repulsive B state at very long range, which does not, at least in a single channel calculation, support any bound states. These dotted lines here are the atomic asymptotes for a ground state lithium atom and the a P lithium atom. The binding energy of this ground state is predicted to be so small that it would be indistinguishable from this dotted line on the scale. And so to look for these things, we just are simply going to tune our laser to the atomic resonance and start scanning to the red until we hit a bound-bound transition. So we do that, and the atomic transition is at 14903.8 wave numbers. And by the time we get about one wave number to the red, we get lucky, and we see these four peaks, which are coming from lithium helium. The spectroscopic interpretation of these two pairs of lines is the following. In the ground state, there is no rotational or vibrational structure. All you have is the hyperfine splitting. And we should expect the binding energy of this molecule is so low, we should expect the wave functions are barely distorted from their atomic wave functions, and so the hyperfine splitting should be pretty much the same as for the atoms. And indeed, the splitting of these two small peaks is, in our experiment, indistinguishable from the ground state hyperfine splitting of lithium 7. So we know it's...
Wait, I mean, is it exactly the same? I mean, well, this is one of the questions people
right.
who work on, like, on atomic clocks. You know, they are always...
Well, surely it's not exactly the same, but my spectroscopy is not very good. So
we're maybe that was actually a modulation of work. I mean, why you're asking this? Because in atomic clocks, you know, it's also one of the systematic effects.
Yeah.
So
the ones with large buffer gas densities, yeah. So I'm not sure exactly how well we're measuring that. I think it's either at the part in 100 level or part in 1,000 level. I think it's just at the part in 100 level measuring that, and so that's okay. It's a very poor way of measuring that interval the way we're doing it. We could do a significantly better job of that if we came back just looking for that.
Can you do microwave transitions?
That would be the way to do it. Although we're probably going to be limited in how well we could even do microwave transitions by the lifetime of the molecule in our buffer gas cell, which is probably not going to be very long. And so that effectively transit time broadening would even make that not very good. Whether that would then be good enough and the signal to noise good enough to then pick out that to see some shift, I think that'd be very interesting to look for. At the moment, we're not equipped to do that.
I wonder where would be the D1 line of lithium atoms compared.
So the D1 line is, I don't remember offhand. It's a little bit to the red of this. So this is the average. This is neglecting fine structure, where the transition would be.
Little bit by wave number.
Not a wave number. So it would be off here somewhere. Uh-huh. I think on the board.
Sir, Jonathan, can you explain again why you think these are bound-to-bound transitions, not scattering to bound?
So, all right, so there's an easy answer and then the hard answer to that scattering to bound. So the simple answer is, well, we're sitting here at 1 Kelvin, and so the thermal width of the scattering to bound would be roughly 20 gigahertz. And we're seeing these lines that are a few hundred megahertz. And so that can't be photo association. Should I leave it there, or?
I guess it works for me.
All right. Okay. Good.
This iodine signal. You have iodine signal on this.
Oh, sorry. I probably shouldn't have this on this graph. This is just for frequency calibration.
Oh, I see.
So after, that's how we calibrate our frequency scale. You either have a $100,000 precision wave meter, or you have a $50 iodine cell. We have the $50 iodine cell. And a nice tabulation of where those lines are. Although, that being said, if we were doing Doppler free spectroscopy of the iodine, we'd have the absolute positions of these lines better. We wouldn't have the relative splitting that much better.
Yeah.
So we're not sure how much the absolute positions matter. It depends how much you care about that excited state structure, which is not our primary interest here. But would be good to measure.
Are the line width of those instrumentally or broadened, or what do you know what the line?
The dominant broadening in this is Doppler broadening.
Doppler. Okay.
Although the pressure broadening is an interesting question that I'll get to later, because then that can perhaps tell us something about the formation rates as well. So we have the ground state hyperfine splitting, ground state hyperfine structure giving us that small splitting. In the excited state hyperfine splitting, that's not resolved because it's smaller than our Doppler broadening, as expected for the atoms. And the large splitting we see is due to the excited state structure here, the different rotational transitions. We have the different rotational progressions with lambda doubling on each of them. We have mixed Hund's case A, B, and C here.
I try. Isn't that resolved?
The excited state?
Yeah, what, in terms of transitions, I don't understand what this meant by excited state hyperfine
splitting. So it's not drawn on here. There's excited state hyperfine structure. The hyperfine constants in the excited state are much smaller than in the ground state. So the splittings are small. We can't resolve it. We can't see it on the atoms either because the Doppler broadening is big. So I tried to get some theorist to calculate this for us, but I couldn't persuade anyone. But Ida told us how to do it. And so we got to play theorist for a little while. I suspect he may have wasted more time explaining how to do it than it would have taken him to do it himself. So we create a model potential based on some precision calculations of the C6 from Zhu et al. And some interpotential. And of course, this gets the vibrational levels in all the wrong places. And so we play around with the interpotential till we get the vibrational states in the right place. And the wave, what the wave function looks like really does not matter on this inner potential very much at all. It's dominated by the C6 and the position of the last bound state, as it would be for scattering calculations or photo association calculations. We tried single channel calculations, and they get the rotational structure slightly wrong because they don't have the lambda doubling. And so we did a couple channel calculations using the A and B potentials, doing the normal couple channel Hamiltonian, kinetic energy term, the molecular potentials, rotation term, and then fine structure, assuming the fine structure constant is unchanged from the atomic value. So we're pretty much just using all the atom numbers combined with this potential. And we find a large splitting that matches the calculated excited state structure to within our error on that excited state calculation, which is confirming that we're looking at lithium 7. Well, from the hyperfine, we know it's lithium 7 bound to a single helium atom. And we're not looking at some cluster, and it's definitely not helium 3, although the chances that it would be helium 3 in our cell where we don't have much helium 3 are pretty preposterous to begin with. So then we can look at the properties of this reaction. The dynamics are going to be complicated because they're driven by cross sections, which are hard to calculate. But the equilibrium properties are easy because that's just thermodynamics. All you need to know is the binding energy of the molecule. And so since that's a single parameter, we can try to extract that parameter from measuring the equilibrium properties. So in equilibrium, I expect the density of molecules to be equal to the product of the density of the atoms with the old partition function here, or 1 over the partition function, times the sum of all the bound states weighted by their Boltzmann factors. And so the first thing we do is just look at how much lithium helium we have as a function of how much lithium we have holding the helium density constant and the temperature roughly constant. And we see this nice linear relationship as expected, which is kind of boring. But the interesting thing is that this linear relationship is independent of when we're looking. And so this is what this is indicating, is that as fast as we can do our detection of these molecules, the population has reached thermal equilibrium, to answer Paul's questions from earlier. And so this is really happening very fast, which is then very convenient for measuring equilibrium properties, because I don't have to pay attention. Everything's just there. We can look as a function of helium density. We see the expected linear relationship. Where it might be interesting is to look at the ratio of how much lithium and helium we have to how much lithium we have as a function of a temperature at a fixed helium density. And now, because this is going to depend on the binding energy, by fitting it to this form, and here we're assuming there's just one bound state, we can extract the binding energy from the equilibrium properties. So we repeat this under a variety of different circumstances.
You said that you assume there is just one state, but
yes.
You just actually determine by doing the spectroscopy on the field helium that there is just one state, so it's not really an assumption.
Yes, well, I guess the assumption is that we didn't screw up. Oh, yes, thank you. Yes, thank you for the faith. Yes, you're right. So we repeat this at different conditions and get a bunch of different measurements of that binding energy and average them together. And what we find is that it's 24 milliwave numbers plus or minus 25 milliwave numbers. The problem is we're doing this experiment up at 1 Kelvin, and that doesn't give you very good resolution on these very low binding energies. To really be sensitive, what we want to do is we want to measure this down to much lower temperatures, but we're limited by the capabilities of our refrigerator, and we're also limited by the helium density. As you get down significantly colder than this, where you could do a significantly better measurement, we run out of helium in the vapor phase, and then we run out of these molecules that we can detect. So unfortunately, the prospects for improving this are not that good, but at least we're consistent with theory, which would have the binding energy around 4 milliwave numbers, although getting our error bar down to that level is a somewhat daunting prospect.
Is that sum just one term?
Sorry, the sum, yeah, I should replace that with where I just have the one single term. That's
so according to these error bars, we could actually have an unbound molecule, right? So it's a little bit tricky, right? So
those are the statistical error bars from the numbers. I think one of the ones I'm not showing actually would give a negative energy, but I know that's not.
In particle physics, they have this one-sided error bar.
You're right.
You are sure that you do have a molecule. Right?
Yes, that's true.
So
you're right.
It should be reflected somehow.
You're right. I should have a lower limit of zero and an upper limit which is statistical. That's right. This is misleading as I have it.
Could you not be seeing a scattering like a threshold resonance?
So that's the harder That's the harder half of the question you asked earlier.
Right.
Could this be
resonance?
Right. So, yeah, if there are no resonances, the photoassociation peak would be 20 gigahertz wide, and clearly that's not what we're seeing. But conceivably, if you had a very, very narrow state there above the threshold, if you make that narrow enough, it's going to act just like a bound state and have the same population.
You see your double structure, which implies you're just duplicating the hyperfine structure.
Exactly.
You can't have the same in both channels.
Exactly.
So
we can, so with that, we can rule out Feshbach, but we can't rule out shape resonance.
No, you can't rule out shape resonance. Well, actually, you can, I think, based on the, yeah.
Actually, two curves correspond to different hyperfine levels.
Exactly. Yeah, but no, this, I mean, in this case, is, right?
No. There is actually exactly the one over R to the C dependence.
Yeah.
So
you get two curves, but they're perfectly parallel. Because the splitting is basically just the atomic splitting, right? It just duplicates the atom in two different spin channels.
Right.
That's what the experiment seems to be suggesting.
So I think this rules out
the rotational energy is far too high to have a shape resonance. So.
Yeah. So for the shape resonance, then it's
orders of magnitude all.
It's a plausibility thing. And what I like looking at for that shape resonance, skipping ahead, is what the ground state wave function would look like, and these are the molecular potentials for the higher order partial waves. And if you look at where this is turning over, it's turning over outside where this barrier is going to be. And so the idea that you can get a shape resonance inside there, I think is very implausible. I would like to have an argument about that didn't rely on the theory, like I can for the Feshbach resonances. But at the moment, I don't have one to rule out a shape resonance in both channels.
Bring this up, but this will allow you to keep your error bars. There's really plausibility.
I don't want the error bars, no. I want the other error bars here. But I think the Feshbach, we can say from the data, it's not that. The shape resonance, I just think, given what the potentials are supposed to look like, are completely implausible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Given those potentials, it's completely impossible.
There's no way you could get a narrow shape resonance there.
I was wondering about the fact that you actually see in your experiment a nearly statistical ratio of the two isotopes.
So the heights are about what you would expect from the degeneracies of the different hyperfine states.
5 to 3.
Yeah. They're a little bit off, and that's because these spectra were taken as a function of time. And so the density of lithium and density of lithium helium are changing. So it's not precisely 5 to 3, but I think that's because we didn't take data for long enough and average enough in both directions of our scan. But that's absolutely right, and a good point to make on that. Absolutely. Thank you. And so then the last thing I wanted to talk about with the three-body recombination is trying to look for recombination rate. And unfortunately, I think Brett Esri was here earlier in the program, but not here anymore, so I can't try to taunt him into extending the range of his calculations. But Brett Esri and collaborators calculated this three-body recombination rate, which is in this upper plot here of helium-4 with helium-4 with lithium-7, produced the lithium-helium cluster, calculating it as a function of temperature, or actually, sorry, energy, up to around 10 millikelvin, which is two orders of magnitude shy of where we're looking. But they predicted at least at 10 millikelvin, it should have a very large rate coefficient for the reaction, in excess of 10 to the minus 27 centimeters to the sixth per second. And I don't have a measurement of that rate, but from looking at our line shapes, we can put an upper limit on what that rate can be. So from the line width, we can find an upper limit on the rate coefficient for collisional dissociation of this molecule. Because the shorter a lifetime that molecule has, the more broadened our line should be. And so from seeing our width, which is dominated by Doppler broadening, I can put a lower limit on the lifetime, which gives an upper limit on this rate coefficient of being less than 10 to the minus 9 centimeters cubed per second. Then from the principle of detailed balance, I can get the rate coefficient for the opposite reaction, and I can put an upper limit of 10 to the minus 29 centimeters to the sixth per second for the three-body recombination rate coefficient, which is significantly lower than what the rate was at 10 millikelvin, or sorry, what the rate was predicted to be at 10 millikelvin, but then again, this curve has not been extended out. And so what we'd like to do in the future is to go back to this with improved optics and improved detection sensitivity and try to measure this recombination rate by using optical pumping to destroy our molecules and watch them be replenished by these three-body recombination coefficients. And I think that's it. So thank you.
Jonathan, you said your formation rate was so fast you couldn't see it because it looked like your molecules. Is there any possible way of what's the time scale when you start probing? How long? That needs to be consistent with this number too, of course.
Right. So
I presume it is.
Yeah. So generally, we're looking. So the first time we look is usually 5 to 10 milliseconds after the ablation pulse.
Okay.
So that's a huge compared to these rate coefficients, and then. The lithium density is changing on the timescales of tens of milliseconds, and so the lithium helium is also following that on that same timescale. Actually, the
temperature is also
changing at the same time, but we're continuously monitoring the temperature and correcting for that, which will play a big role in how much lithium helium we have.
So basically, with the kind of densities you've got, that probably you're having many, many elastic collisions over the time scale before you start looking.
Yes, yeah, definitely. Okay. Yeah, yes. Absolutely.
So there is currently a debate in the literature about the existence of a bound state in the triple state of the lithium hydride. Does your result have any implications on that?
Sorry, triple state of lithium hydride.
Yeah, LiH triplets. So some calculations show that there is a bound state, others show there's none, and there's no experiments. So the question is, does your measurement have any implications on that?
Back when we were looking at the lithium hydride, or?
No, I'm just thinking that the fact that lithium helium has a bound state, does it have any implications on the fact that
Maybe, but that's above my theory grade.
I guess one would have to think about the polarizability. I mean, does anyone know about the polarizability of hydrogen versus helium?
Yes.
So helium is more polarizable.
Helium
is less.
Helium is 0.2 cubic angstroms, and hydrogen is about 1.
So hydrogen is more polarized.
More
so that means that the potential should be deeper. That means that
depends, you know. For a similar problem, like with lithium, you're in compared with helium.
Yeah, but
you're
it's lithium in the same case.
C6,
but we have lithium and helium.
Well, there's a chain interaction, right?
So, but there's a chain interaction in lithium.
Yeah,
too,
but it's in lithium the same as both. Whereas in helium is no lithium, so it's the difference between helium and lithium.
Yeah, I'm comparing lithium helium with lithium hydrogen.
But I mean, the chemical bonds are different, right?
So, but there's no chemical bond in either.
Your earlier argument suggested it would have a bound state.
The bond order is zero for lithium hydrogen. But if the polarizability of hydrogen is bigger than that of helium, that would suggest. So I'm just thinking that, you know, if you haven't written this up, you might want to look into it. Because, you know, if you provided evidence of the fact that lithium hydrogen exists, that would be a big deal.
Mm-hmm. I think it's too late on that for this. Yes.
My argument would be that if this exists, and if the other potential is different, then the other one has to.
Well, it's a bit lighter. Hydrogen's a bit lighter. But then, yes, the reduced mass is going to be factor of 2 smaller.
No, I have no proof it is to measure it. That spectroscopy, I don't want to do it. that's hard spectroscopy. This is easy spectroscopy. Yeah.
Like a lot of factors that are.
I know, but what if they work all in the same way?
It's not that bad because the upper state is also extremely weakly bound. We're going to the last vibration level. Yeah. It's bad, but it's not that bad. We got very lucky in that respect because there happened to be a bound level that's very close to the asymptote. Yeah. Okay. Oh, sorry.
Another question for Jonathan. Are you thinking about looking at the isotope log that you're hearing four as opposed to hearing three?
So the I don't remember if
but less.
I'm pretty sure lithium 6 is bound to helium 4. Okay. I don't remember if either of the lithium isotopes are bound to helium 3.
Okay.
I think that would be interesting to look for, although a little bit harder because there is less of that isotope. Yeah, relatively straightforward. I should also say we got a little bit lucky with the lithium 7 helium 4, which I was just talking about here, in that how big the Frank-Condon factor will be in this transition depends on the overlap of these, which will depend how close to the asymptote that last bound state of the A potential is. And here we got lucky in that it was bound by only one wave number, which gave us a much larger Frank-Condon factor than we had any right to expect. So in our current version of the apparatus, we don't have enough signal to noise, I think, to see the lithium 6, helium 4, unless we got even luckier with this. In the next version where we're improving our sensitivity, I think those experiments become viable.
Because I'm thinking about the possibility of depleting the dimer by applying a field. And then using a depleted command for the measurement of the recombination.
That would be nice. Yeah. In our current apparatus, though, I'm not sure we can get the field in.
Yeah.
So we'll have to go with laser field. And so probably because we already have the laser on resonance, probably just doing the on resonance laser field and then essentially doing the optical pumping. Assuming that the Frank-Condon factor from the excited state is dominated by decay to unbound atoms, we can get somewhat rapid depletion. That being said, if the rate really was as high as was theoretically predicted, we couldn't do that at our current helium densities because the rate at which the population would be replenished would exceed the excited state lifetime. But at least our initial measurements indicate that it's not this high. And so once we improve our detection, we can go down to lower helium densities and now slow that down to a level where we should be able to measure it by depleting it.
We'll adjourn for the day.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, John.